that's where we left off, was the entrance of Alexander into the nation, or into Jerusalem. So, yeah, I was going to ask for questions, so go right ahead.
Yeah, so there's certain historical accounts that claim that Alexander believed that he was actually the son of a god. He was a demigod.
You know?
Zeus was his dad, correct? Right? He believed that. And that's part of the reason why he had that mindset that I could do anything because, you know. Is there any sort of way that he reconciled these things in his mind, you know, having offerings being sacrificed to the one true God versus his pagan sort of beliefs and what he was raised to believe in Greece? I mean, is there any sort of reconciliation that's written about any of that?
I don't know if there's anything written about it, but usually the reconciliation is something called syncretism, right? So, and we're going to be getting into syncretism here a little bit because that's what takes place from this point forward. Syncretism is you take some Greek paganism, you take some Judaism, you put it in a blender, and you mix them together. And you come up with a unique form of a religion that blends both together. We see this a lot when Catholics go into new areas that have foreign gods, and they just blend it all together. We'll see that with the Samaritans when we talk about them today. Hopefully we'll get to them today. But the Samaritans did that as well, you know, in their earlier stages, and they stopped doing it by the time of Christ. But again, we'll get into that. So there's nothing that I know that's written there. It could be like the way Cyrus did it. You know, Cyrus and the Persians, they had a thought that every locality had their own gods, and we need to make sure that we honor them and allow people to worship them the way that they see fit. So probably was something along those lines. Yeah, the unknown God. Yeah, that sure seems to be the indication, right? I just think he probably thought it was another one, but Zeus was probably higher and, you know. Yeah, good question. Anybody else have any questions? Okay, let's keep going. What happened in 323 BC with Alexander? Anybody remember? What's that? It's not when he got the vision. Good guess though. Good guess. That was when he died. Close. Yep. You can edit your answer if you so choose. Yeah. So 323 is when he died at 32 years old. 32 years old. So it's one of those things where, you know, God gave him the vision. Yeah, you're going to conquer the Persians. But he didn't tell him. Yeah, then you're going to die. So why did Alexander die? Well, from what I've read, he got sick and died from his sickness. Then what happens is you have the wars of the Diadochi. So the Diadochi were the generals that took over after Alexander, and there were four of them. The ones that don't really concern us too much are Lysimachus and Cassander, and the other two are the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. So Ptolemy and Seleucus were the generals, and they had their folks. So the Ptolemies ruled Egypt, and the Seleucids ruled from the easternmost area into Persia, going that way, all the way up into Turkey and down into Israel. Now, it's interesting, the way that this worked is that there was a carve-out inside of Israel where the middle of Israel was ruled by the Ptolemies, but they were surrounded by Seleucid rule. So you can imagine how well that went. And when you hear of something called the Wars of the Diadochi, and those are the four generals that started dividing up Alexander's kingdom, you can tell that that didn't go so well. Those wars lasted, I think, 42 years. 42 years, where there were wars all over that empire. And the ones that concern us again are the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and they battled as well. So what ends up happening is the destruction happened in piecemeal fashion. The Ptolemies had control from 301 to about the 200, to about the year 200. So they were based out of Egypt. So what they did is they had a systematized program all the way throughout that area. For the first time in history, Egypt and Jerusalem used the same currency. So that same currency was used throughout that whole area. Now, as we know, what's the big deal in our day and age? The dollar being the reserve currency of the world, right? Trump's big concept is, you know, he's going to penalize nations who try to replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Because when you have a singular currency, there's a lot of perks to go with that. But it also makes doing business a lot easier than having to trade back and forth into currencies all the time. That's why countries keep reserves in American dollars. And that helps our country. All right. Now, that can also be used as a weapon, but it helps facilitate easy trade. Now, what ends up taking place here is that Egypt was the center, and they had a singular economy, or singular currency would probably be a better way to say it, with Jerusalem. So that facilitated a lot of prosperity, relatively speaking, especially from what they did have, that versus what they had before. All right. So they used what's called the Phoenician system, same as Egypt, first time ever. So they had trade with Egypt increased, of course. They had market regulations, price controls. We have all of these different kinds of things that helped bring prosperity to that land. Because if you think about the geography there, from Greece, if you want to get to Egypt, if you're not going by sea, where do you got to go? You got to go through Jerusalem. If you're coming from the eastern part of the empire and you're going to Egypt, where you got to go? You got to go through Jerusalem. Now, you could go across the desert if you wanted to, but that's probably not the best route. You go through major trade routes. Jerusalem was right there at the hub of a major trade center. Now, who can tell me, when it comes to the nation of Israel, Jerusalem specifically, something major happened during the reign of the Ptolemies that we still have benefit of religiously today? And it was a huge benefit for people using the Bible in the days of Jesus. It was a translation of the Bible.
Septuagint?
Yeah, the Septuagint. This takes place during this time frame. All right. So you have the Septuagint translation project right around 280 BC. From Ptolemy II Philadelphus was his title. Now, here's the scale of the project. Now, what does LXX stand for? Anybody want, shout it out.
Septuagint?
Yeah, Septuagint. It's Roman numerals. Yes, 70. Now, guess how many translators there were that translated the Septuagint? You would think that, wouldn't you? Because someone said 70. You would think that because LXX stands for 70. There are 72. LXX is just a lot, you know, smoother than LXXII. You know, we can say it better. It's a lot easier to abbreviate. There was actually 72 Jewish scholars that were brought. And where was the Septuagint translated? What city? Alexandria, the hub of the Jewish diaspora, where the Jews had been scattered. So Alexandria was a major hub for Jewish settlers at this time. So they had 72 scholars brought to Alexandria, individual translation cells constructed, comparative analysis procedures where they're comparing the Hebrew over to the Greek. Because think about it. How hard is it to translate the entire Old Testament from Hebrew, which is a little bit more of a general language, words can have multiple meanings, to Greek, which is a much more specific language? That'd be difficult. Because in Greek, you also have all these aspects to the verbs that you don't have in Hebrew. So it would have been a very challenging project to get done. So they had to create a comparative analysis procedure to discern and to decide how things were going to get translated. They obviously did a really good job because quite a bit, if not the majority of Old Testament quotes in the New Testament are from the Septuagint. That's the version Paul would have used because he was a Hellenistic Greek. Okay. All right. So The impact on Jewish thought as a result of this. It was the first major Old Testament translation in history. Greek philosophical terms entered into Jewish discourse, just in society as well. Theological vocabulary expanded, because when you bring in new words and new language, you bring in new thoughts that kind of go along with that. Here's a good one. In Isaiah 7:14, there's a really interesting messianic prophecy, right? Talks about how the virgin will conceive. And the Hebrew word is Alma. And it can simply mean just an unmarried woman. Now, the assumption is, if you were unmarried in that culture, you were a virgin. That was what was expected. And there were consequences if you weren't. So the Septuagint translators had to take a step back and say, okay, we have all these different words in Greek, so how are we going to translate this? Well, they say, we're going to use the word Parthenos, which does mean virgin. So even though they're translating it, there's also a little bit of interpretation that goes along with it. Now, I would never put the Septuagint above the Hebrew because of that fact, because there's some interpretation that goes along with it. But I will use the Septuagint where the New Testament uses it, because there's an inspiration factor that's going along with there, where God's saying, yeah, that was a good one. And you see that sometimes, that there's a difference between the quote in the New Testament versus the source material in the Old Testament. And my advice to you all, whenever you see that, always check the Septuagint first, because it's probably quoting from the Septuagint and it's different than the Hebrew. Not by a lot, typically, but the word order might be a little bit different and some of the other thoughts might be a little bit different. And then, you know, that's when they really had to come down and create also some really systematized biblical interpretation methods. Because we can't, you know, if you think about it, if you're going from Hebrew Old Testament to Greek Old Testament, you can't just have arbitrary rules on how you're going to do things. And it needs to be systematized. They need to be concrete as much as possible. And, you know, that's my approach when it comes to the Bible as well. I'm not going to interpret the Bible in whatever way seems best to me. It's written in literature for a reason. So we need to use proper hermeneutics to interpret it. Now, there also is a little bit of art that goes along with that to determine when the rules apply and when they don't apply, or how the rules apply. So there is nuance there. So there is flexibility. But, you know, it doesn't take very long to have a conversation with somebody or to get involved online and see the way people interpret the Bible to recognize, oh man, that's just horrible, you know, the way that people are looking at it. There's this one guy that I saw. He annoys me, so I blocked him. No, it wasn't Jeremiah. No, but this guy is a hardcore Calvinist, and he is trashing the book of James because he says James disagrees with Paul on how salvation is done, because, you know, justification by faith versus justification by works. And the first thing, so he's tracking along with like Martin Luther, you know, just James, you know, I don't know if he's saying James shouldn't be part of the Bible or what, but his hermeneutical methods are horrible. And his comments, his hermeneutical method is horrible. So it's like, okay, look, if your doctrine disagrees with the book of James, your doctrine's wrong. You don't know more than he does. Paul and James didn't disagree at all. They're emphasizing different aspects of justification. And James even states what he means by justification by works. Justification by works, your deeds show what your faith is. And he's actually making the point, you can't just have blind faith and have cognitive assent, cognitive belief, without a change of action. That's not a belief. That's not faith. Right? That's what he's saying. And so many people miss that. But anyway, that's a good example of a tangent off of my main point. So Parthenos and Alma. All right. That's all we're going to talk about with the Ptolemies. I don't want to belabor that point. Anybody got any questions on that? Just wanted to hit the highlights. All right, here's the fun stuff. So in 200, in a place called Panium, or Panayim, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, which is in Lebanon, at the base of Mount Hermon. All right? There was a battle between Antiochus III and Ptolemy V, and it changed everything. That's when Antiochus III, that's when the Seleucids gained control over Jerusalem, and the Ptolemies were beat back into Egypt. Now, initially, this was wonderful for the Jews. All right? They had temple privileges confirmed. They had tax exemptions for priests. They had religious laws recognized, festival observances protected, new governors appointed, the tax system was restructured, all kinds of good things where the Jews would have been, yes, this is great. But remember, what's taking place at this whole time is the introduction of Greek thought, philosophy, and religion in that area. So there's bound to be conflict, right? There has to be conflict. Even under the Ptolemies, there was conflict. Even though they had freedom, remember, Alexander's command was for the Hellenization of the world. Greek culture, Greek thought, Greek religion. But Antiochus III decided to give them a lot of freedom. Now, the military presence was also increased because, you know, when you have a turnover like that and battles are being fought around you, and, you know, there are certain parts of the population that might want to take advantage of any power vacuum that might be around. You know, nature, spiritual nature and physical nature abhors a vacuum. It will always be filled. You know, that's why I always think it's funny when people, you know, say we should have anarchy. It will never exist. You can never have a vacuum. Something will always fill it. In an anarchy with no law, you won't like what fills the vacuum at all. Because typically it's the strongest, and the strongest are not typically the nicest. That's just the way it works. That's another thing for another time. And so now, instead of Egypt, now everything shifts north because the Seleucid range was a lot more north and east. So they changed the monetary system. They moved from that Phoenician system where Egypt and everybody was on the same, and they moved to something called the Attic system. And it was like the rest of the empire. So they went on the system that the rest of the empire was on. After Antiochus III, I think it was, well, doesn't matter. He was after. I can't remember if he was directly after. I don't think he was directly after. I think there were a couple of other guys before him. There arose a new gentleman, a new king. Gentleman is a nice word, but it really doesn't apply to him. His name, and you should know this name from this point forward, if you don't know it already, because he plays a major role. His name is Antiochus IV Epiphanes, or shortened to Antiochus Epiphanes. So what happens here is that the Hellenization process gets drastically amplified. And we talked about this last week. Antiochus built a gymnasium next to the temple. And you think, great, he built a gym next to the gymnasium. So when you're done offering your sacrifices, you're done praying, you can go play some hoops, lift some weights, you know, get a good pump on, fantastic, and then go home. No, because there's an idol in there. And you work out au naturel. So the Jews were like, this is not acceptable at all. It was an affront to their modesty, and having it so close to the Temple Mount with an idol there did not work. So Antiochus also renamed Jerusalem Antiochia after himself. How do you think that went over? So the high priesthood was sold. In other words, he had complete control over it. Something else he did, and we're going to get into this a little bit more when we go into the Maccabean Revolt. We're going to have a whole time on the Maccabean Revolt because that's important. He raided the temple treasury. He stole the money from the temple. he then sacrificed a pig on the altar, made people eat pork as a way to force them to convert to the Greek pantheon of gods. And we'll get more into that as we dive into the Maccabean Revolt, but it was bad. And he started killing people who wouldn't convert. It was a dire, horrible time frame. And the Jews had enough, and up came the Maccabean Revolt, which we'll get into specifically, I think probably next week. We're going to, like I said, do a whole message on that. Territorial developments, regional divisions emerged. So here is where you really get into the division between Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. This is really where it first starts. Now, of course, we know where the division originally started, right? You know, that goes all the way back to when the kingdom split. You've got the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. And after the Assyrians conquered and destroyed them, they moved in a bunch of people during that time frame to take over, right? And remember, the lions came in and started eating people. So the king of Assyria sent a priest back there, and they, and again, we'll get into that a little bit more next week. Hold on, right here. Sorry. Yeah, 2 Kings 17. Let's go there. Let's look at that now. Second Kings 17. And we're going to start in verse 24. This is really the beginning of Samaria as we know it in the Bible, in the New Testament. It says, the king of Assyria, Second Kings 17, verse 24. The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cutha, and from Ava, and from Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and settled them in the cities of Samaria and the place of the sons of Israel. So they possessed Samaria and lived in the cities. At the beginning of their living there, they did not fear the Lord. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you have carried away into exile in the cities of Samaria do not know the custom of the God of the land. So he sent lions among them, and behold, they kill them because they do not know the customs of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, take one of the priests whom you carried away into exile, and let him go and live there, and let him teach them the custom of the God of the land. So one of the priests whom they had carried away into exile from Samaria came and lived at Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. But every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the houses of the high places which the people of Samaria had made, every nation in their cities in which they lived. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth. The men of Cuth made Nergal. The men of Hamath made Ashima. The Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak. And the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and to Anamelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves priests of high places who acted for them in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord and served their own gods according to their custom of the nations from whom they had been carried away into exile. So you can see that this is called syncretism. This is the mixture of both of these together. Now, when they say fear the Lord, what he's talking about is they were offering sacrifices. They had fear of God. And so they offered sacrifices to appease him like they would their children to the gods of Sepharvaim. So he was just another one of the gods that needed to be appeased. But they were still in utter rebellion to him, right? I mean, this doesn't work. God is not some wrathful, pagan, demonic deity that needs to be satiated by the blood of children. Right? That's not how this works. So when you go down a little bit further, you know, we see a lot of commands here from 34 to 39. But verse 40, he says, however, they did not listen, but they did according to their earlier custom. So while these nations feared the Lord, they also served the idols their children likewise, and their grandchildren as their fathers did, so they do to this day. So as this was being written by in 2 Kings, they were still doing the exact same thing. Okay? So this formation of Samaria started here, 722. But then what happens is that they're changed into more distinct regions during the time of the Persians, but then specifically in the times of the Greeks. You specifically have Judea in the south, and you have Samaria, and then Galilee was this no man's land. It was pretty rural, pretty unimportant. Everything changed after the Greeks, and we haven't gotten here yet, but we'll get to it in a little bit. Everything changed when the Greeks were out of power and the Jews got their own independence. There was a king that they had, he didn't call himself king, I don't believe, but Hyrcanus or Hyrcanus, depends on how you want to pronounce it. What he did is he went up and conquered Samaria. They had a temple on Mount Gerizim. That's where the whole, remember the Samaritan woman at the well? You say, Jerusalem's the place to worship, our fathers worship on this mountain? That's Mount Gerizim. They had a temple on there. The Jews destroyed it in right around 111 to 110. That's where a lot of the hostility comes between the Samaritans and the Jews. You can even date it back to where Ezra and Nehemiah, Ezra specifically rejected any outside help in rebuilding, right? So that's all part of that too. So there was this animosity. And then what happens in 9 AD, on the eve of Passover, some Samaritans broke into the temple ground and scattered human bones all over the temple and the temple grounds, making everything unclean. So you have this, back and forth between the Samaritans and the Jews of animosity that really dates back around the concept of the temple. But in the time of Rome, it's where we finally see Judea, Galilee, and Samaria created as individual provinces. That's where that started. But you can see the evolution of that as we move forward. All right, questions or comments on that? Okay. Let's keep going. Trade routes, east-west trade routes remain. So a lot of wealth still coming in, except Antiochus was taking it all. The Decapolis became formed by, you remember how Jesus, they went into the Decapolis area quite a bit. That was also formed during this time. And then in 168, Rome enters the scene. So what you have here is Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, went down and conquered Egypt, conquered the Ptolemies. Rome was a burgeoning superpower at this time. They were pretty impressive. And they decided, we don't like this. So what happened is you have Pompilius, who is an ambassador. He goes down into Egypt and talks to Antiochus IV. And he says, you're going to withdraw from Egypt and go back up where you came from and leave them alone. We don't like this power grab that you're doing. And Antiochus is like, well, I don't want to make Rome mad, but I don't like this. Let me think about it. So Pompilius did this really awesome move. He walked up to Antiochus, drew a circle in the sand around him, and said, I will have my answer by the time you leave the circle. That's awesome, isn't it? That's a power move right there. And so he goes, okay. So he left and went back up to Jerusalem, or back up to where he came from. And that is the beginning of the strength of Rome being projected into that whole area. So I think that was pretty cool. So Rome, Jewish delegations went to Rome to ask for their help. And when we get into the concept of the Maccabean revolt, the Jews or the Romans did help a little bit. Now, after this all took place, we have the Maccabean revolt, which again, we'll get into next week, completely kicked out the Greeks from power, and they became independent over a course of a few decades. They then decided to, their priests became their leaders, but they weren't from the line of Zadok as they were supposed to be. All right. They were from the previous line. God had stated Zadok's line was the line that was going to move forward. These priests were not from that line, but they assumed control anyway. And the next thing that they did is something that was completely forbidden by the Old Testament. They proclaimed themselves king. So you had king, not from the line of David, and priest, not from the line of Zadok, functioning as the supreme rulers. This is when the Essenes especially rejected the temple leadership and completely isolated away from the regular Jews. So that community in Qumran that made the Dead Sea Scrolls, it all happened around this time. All because these priests decided to declare themselves king. And that completely move them off to, and they're like, okay, we gotta have all this. So they made their own library. Now, I don't know if that was a direct cause, but that was the result. This is all pretty cool. How God uses these events. He uses the sin of people to create something that we're going to use in the 20th century to help prove the Bible's the Word of God. That's awesome. That's fantastic. So then what happens is, you know, they go and they do this conquering. They, John Hyrcanus, or Hyrcanus, however you pronounce it, forcefully converted what are called the Edomites, which were also called the Idumeans, and brought them into the fold. Anybody want to take a guess who the most famous Idumean was during the birth of Christ? Herod the Great. So that's how Herod came into being part of that, was by John Hyrcanus forcefully converting him. And he also, him and his son Aristobulus, I believe was his name, they forcefully converted all the Galileans that weren't Jews. So Iturians, I believe, is what they were called. And now we see how that all came about. So what happens is you have a couple of brothers. Let me see if I can grab their names real quick. Got all of these. Nope, not that one. There we go. I've got all these little handouts here. So you have Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. They were brothers. They went into a civil war in about 67 to 63, somewhere around there. No, 63. And Aristobulus won. So Hyrcanus goes to a Roman general by the name of Pompey, and he asks for Pompey to intervene, and Pompey says, well, here's what I'll do. I'm going to try a diplomatic solution first. But Aristobulus and Hyrcanus were like, nope. So Pompey says, fine, you now belong to us, and he besieged Jerusalem and said, you guys are ours now. Since you can't get along. And that is how Rome came to be in control of Jerusalem, of Judea. I find this stuff fascinating, how all this works out. And then, you ready for a really cool piece? And I think I've mentioned this before, but not like this. So everything changed. The political landscape changed. Local, governments became under the authority of Rome. Now, Herod the Great did rule Judea, Samaria, and Galilee until 4 AD. No, 4 BC. His son took over and made a complete mess. And then what happens is that the Roman governors then come in at that particular point. And I believe that was right around 6 AD. You know what else happened at 6 AD? The Jews lost the ability to exercise capital punishment. How does the Old Testament say Jesus was going to die? Crucifixion. Do you know what the method of execution, capital punishment, was before 6 AD for the last 1,500 years? Stoning. So the Messiah, since he was going to be crucified, could only have come during a 63-year window between 6 AD and 70 AD, when crucifixion was the method of execution. That's the only window that was allowed for the Messiah to come because of the Old Testament prophecy. Yeah, Brian's got a comment, question, not sure which.
So we knew that there was a definitive starting point for the crucifixion as a form of execution. I didn't know there was an end point. Like the Romans did away with that?
Well, it's because Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD.
Well, I got you. I see what you're saying. So it didn't matter if you can...
Yeah, it could have been after.
Yeah, I got you.
But if it was Jerusalem during that time frame, that was when Jerusalem was around as a... Think about it. If Jesus wouldn't even have mattered to these guys after 70 AD because of Jerusalem. I mean, the temple was destroyed. He wouldn't have been able to fulfill any of his prophecies. Tribe of David goes away. So 6 AD to 70 AD is that narrow little time frame. Isn't that super cool? Now, on the flip side, they had other methods of execution. You know, they would behead people too, by the sword. God looks throughout all of history. And he decides amongst himself that the Messiah is going to die, has to die for the sins of the world. You know, this is all done before he says, let there be light. And he makes the decision for that narrow piece of time where crucifixion is the method of death versus stoning. Now, I want you to think about this for a second. Who is in complete and utter control of when the Messiah comes? God is. And he doesn't choose for the Messiah to come when he can be stoned to death in a relatively quick process compared to crucifixion or being beheaded. He doesn't, you know, allow Jesus to be still Jewish and, like Paul, born a Roman citizen, so that he would be beheaded. No. He picks that time frame. And he picks that method of execution. All so that he could say, when the Son of Man be lifted up, I will draw all men to myself. See, it wasn't just that Jesus had to die for the sins of mankind. The method of his death is also primarily what draws people to him because of the manner of that death. If you think about it, if it was quick like beheading, people would have been like, he didn't even feel a thing. If I had my choice of any way for me, if I had to be executed, for any way for me to go, I'd either pick the guillotine or firing squad. That's the way I'd want to go. And people who were trained marksmen, not, you know, Jim Bob who's just drank a 12-pack. Guillotine, firing squad, in that order. My point is, crucifixion would not be anywhere on that list. If I got to choose. See, so it was also the method by which Jesus died. And think about the interactions that he had upon that cross. How many of those bring people to him? He's up there suffering and he's saving somebody's soul. He's taking care of his mom. He's fulfilling prophecy. He's praying to the Lord. All of these things are recorded for us so that that's part of the drawing of people to him. That it's not some quick, easy, and painless death. It's agonizing and torturous. And God picked that. And that time, a very narrow sliver of history where that was going to be possible. To me, that puts the sacrifice of Christ in an entirely new light. Questions or comments on that before we finish up here? Okay. So when the Romans took over, you also have the language setup that's necessary. You have a trilingual society. Aramaic for daily life, Hebrew for religious purposes, and Greek for administrative and commercial languages. Again, like I said, I watch reels and stuff to, and I've got some reels that I've saved for our future episodes that we're going to be using. But I saw this one. It's this Australian lady. You always find those ones that are really interesting where they start off the reel and you're like, oh, this is going to be one of those gotcha reels, huh? And she's like, so what language did Jesus speak? Oh, Aramaic. What language was the Bible written in? Greek. See, so these aren't the words of Jesus. He spoke Aramaic. He didn't speak Greek. And none of his disciples spoke Greek. The subtle implication there is because they're dumb and they're like everybody else who are just typically monolingual. They were trilingual. They would have spoken Aramaic. They would have spoken some Hebrew. The more educated would have spoken fluent Hebrew. And they would have spoken Greek. Because it's a major trade route and you've got these people going all through it. In all administrative and commercial dealings with anybody outside of the nation was done in Greek. So every business person would have had to speak Greek. And they would have spoken Greek for the last 300 years. So it's not something that's foreign to them. It was ingrained in the culture. You also have a social stratification that takes place. The priesthood became the wealthy class, the power class. Again, that's a holdover from the Hasmoneans, but it was still very much ingrained during this time frame. Scribes gained influence. You have the following of the Pharisee and the Sadducees and those guys going after each other because of different religious views, conservative versus liberal, essentially. Merchants grew wealthy with all of the Roman trade going through there. And perfect timing for the Messiah. The road structure, the language structure. I mean, think about this. Paul was and all of these folks were able to travel all throughout the Roman Empire without any language barrier whatsoever. Because everybody spoke Greek. Everybody spoke Greek. Synagogue systems had spread. And of course, there's all the messianic prophecies that we've gone over that really do hammer home the messianic expectation that was necessary. People just knew. Plus the messianic prophecies specifically out of Daniel, they knew 26 AD was a prime year. Something was going to happen in and or around that time frame. because that was when the Messiah was going to appear. They were expecting him. So, all right, we're going to stop there, and we'll pick up with the Maccabean Revolt next week. Questions, comments? We wrap up.